Marcus Young. How you doing?
Good, Becca.
The Offspring.
How's it going, Becca?
Dave Grohl. How you going, mate?
Good, man.
Pete, it's been a long time coming.
Oh, Becca, hasn't it indeed?
We go inside the dressing room, speak to the biggest names in music.
Keith Richards, the Rolling Stones.
And crack open their esky.
This is exactly how I imagined you, by the way, sitting opposite me with a vodka and orange.
You're a discerning chap.
This is The Rider.
Hey, it's Becca. Welcome back to The Rider. What are we into series four now? And I thought it was never going to work out. Well, I mean, I thank you for subscribing and for checking it out. Back again for another series. Plenty of industry types already locked in to come on. Plenty of bands and musicians. If you missed where we left off at the end of season three, it was Matt Sorum, formerly of Guns N' Roses, opening up as he released his new book.
I remember I came home and I stopped by the liquor store and I walked in and I said, Axel just fired me and I think this time it's for real. Because he had fired me many times before.
Yeah.
But, you know, and he used to call me too and say it like this. You're fired!
Matt Sorum from Guns N' Roses. Check out his book. It is called Double Talk and Jive. And, of course, catch up on that chat in the previous season of The Rider along with Mark Opitz, legendary producer. Even Jim Kerr from Simple Minds, that is all there right now on Spotify and Apple. There's plenty more to recap. Things I've missed. I've been away concentrating on a career pretty much since the end of last year. I don't want to bore you with that stuff, but I was involved with an election and all that stuff, which goes on with getting someone elected into Parliament. Unfortunately, she lost, so I was on the hunt for a job. Anyway, that's all sorted out now, which is great. Plenty has happened, though, in the last few months. Power Trip Festival has been announced, which is pretty much happening on the same grounds as Coachella, so it's going to be a lot of rock fans heading down to Palm Springs to see bands live. AC/DC, who made their return. I mean, we all thought it was going to happen eventually, but Akadaka are playing along with Guns N' Roses, Metallica, and Ozzy Osbourne also making his return. That's October 6th in Palm Springs. Also, while I was away, a brand new album from the Foo Fighters. I was able to check this out just before it was released, and we sat in this room and listened to an album from the Foo Fighters I never really experienced before. When you think about Dave, he lost his best friend, Taylor Hawkins. They were right in the middle of a tour. And around that same time, he lost his mum. And we all know how close he was to his mum. And of course, they did a TV show together. They were extremely close. So Dave's had two tragedies in the space of a few months. And that's what went into this album. But here we are. The Aussie dates are out as well. So they're coming to town in December. And the world tour continues, and you might have even seen them in Glastonbury already as well, under a different name. But what a surprise that was to have the Foo Fighters pop up with a surprise gig at Glastonbury last weekend. Also, big news which happened was this. Ben and Chris from Silverchair, they have announced a book which is going to be called Love and Pain. No mention of Daniel Johns at all in the promo for this new book, so it's going to be really interesting what they talk about. And of course, as we know, Daniel Johns had his say on his podcast last year, so this is Ben and Chris having their writer reply.
This is The Rider.
Season 4 of The Rider, what a great way to start it off with Jeff Martin, who you know from this band, The Tea Party. This song came out in 1991. We're going to find out why this song and this album was so integral to their success right across the world. Now, Jeff is back with a brand new album. What's happened is he's moved to the Sunshine Coast. He's always loved living in Australia. He's got a lovely wife and family here. On the Sunshine Coast, he's got his own studio and he's been working away on this new album. Seven Deadly Sins. This is the opening track, Lust. I reckon you can get a vibe on this album hearing this opening track. Check out this one. This is track 7. Gluttony. Safe Amongst the Stars. The album is out on the 7th of the 7th, so just coming up in a few days' time, depending on when you download the podcast. But I can see Jeff popping up on my screen in front of me. There he is. Look at him. Jeff Martin, how are you?
I'm very well, my friend. It's been a long time between drinks.
It has been a long time, and I know that You've been waiting a while to release this project. The number seven, it has a significance to you, obviously.
Yes, well, it does. I mean, you know, I'm a self-taught student of, occult philosophies. There is a book that Aleister Crowley wrote a long time ago called 777. That book has its, it would be like a manual for attributions towards different things, like, for instance, astrology, the Kabbalah, things like that, right? And everything has a correlation. That's kind of become a part of my signature, that 777 thing. Yeah.
And I had to ask you about that because obviously I found out later on that the number seven featured a lot, including obviously Seven Deadly Sins, which is coming out on the 7th of the 7th. That's a huge deal. I know you've been trying to tour and you had a few false starts during COVID as well.
Yeah, well, I was actually one of the fortunate ones as an artist, like a performing artist, because it seemed that, like how the lockdowns went down, when I had to do some touring during the pandemic, we kind of were able to go interstate here in Australia and just get in and get out before everything shut down again, right?
Yeah.
Like even going as far as WA, managed to do that a couple times during the lockdown, which is... it's no easy feat because WA was the most strict, as far as the pandemic was concerned. But, we got there in the end. Here we are now.
And I was going through some of the great Canadian artists and many you just kind of forget. We all know Neil Young, obviously, but Joni Mitchell and Leonard Cohen and Geddy Lee and of course we know Bryan Adams and Alanis, obviously, but the Tea Party go down as being one of the great, alt rock bands of Canadian history. In fact, you were the front runners.
Okay, I don't know if we're the front runners, but the thing is, though, is that our success traveled beyond Canada, right? Like, well, for instance, here in Australia, when our first record with the Tea Party, when Splendor Solace came out, Australia, Triple J, was one of the first proactive, just endorsees, this unknown Canadian band at that time, right? And because of Australia and because of Triple J's involvement back then, that actually morphed into success for us into Europe, right? So we were very fortunate at that time, because you have to remember, back in 1993 when Splendor Solace came out, most North American rock bands were trying to sound like Teen Spirit,
Yeah, that's right.
Not sound, but sound. And we, the three of us, Jeff and I and Stuart, like we didn't really want part and parcel of the whole grunge thing. It wasn't our thing. Like we wanted to do something more. And we wanted to... explore, music from the Middle East, from India, from Morocco, and put it into that hard rock setting. Yeah, because truth be told, when the Tea Party was formed back in 1990, I had this vision. It was a sonic vision. Because Led Zeppelin, when I was growing up as a teenager, like Jimmy Page was a massive influence on my guitar playing and my what would become my composition skills And but the one song that really stuck out for me from Led Zeppelin was Kashmir.
Yeah.
And yeah. I felt that we could take that a lot further in different ways. And I think, you know, truth be told, The Edges of Twilight, our sophomore record, was the moment that the Tea Party did take it further and in different ways.
That's true. You, I missed the power of radio where, you know, back then it just took one DJ who was passionate about a band and it could go nationwide. But as you said, it can go international as well. I love that. That's what happened back then. And, you know, even Australia having an influence on Europe. Were you being pressured at all by record companies to go down the grunge era, or you were still fairly independent back then, weren't you? Like, you had your own record company, didn't you? So did you have those pressures?
In 1990, we released an independence records, right, that became the calling card for us to then, in 1993, we got signed to EMI Canada. Now, so we get signed to EMI Canada, and because of my, my obsession at the time with Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin, right? I, you know, stomped on the ground and, you know, created like a hissy fits with EMI to the point where I became, at that point, I don't know if it's changed now, but at that point, I became the youngest ever producer for EMI Records, because I produced the first Tea Party EMI release, Splendor Solus, right?
Yeah.
And truth be told, I really didn't know what I was doing, but I had a great engineer working with me who taught me the ropes, because I could hear everything in my head. But at that time, I didn't know how to get it, you know, to tape, because we're talking about tape machines back then.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, compressors and all that stuff and different microphone techniques and everything. But yeah, like, so I, you know, they called my bluff. EMI called my bluff. And luckily for us, for Jeff and I and Stuart, it was a huge success, you know, so that afforded us for the next record, The Edges of Twilight. Now, obviously, because of the success of the first record, Splendor Solus, the next one, Edges of Twilight, well, you know, we had a recording budget that doesn't exist anymore.
Tell us about where you recorded this Seven Deadly Sins in Sunshine Coast. You've got a studio just down the road, and tell us about that environment, because I can hear the sounds you're describing from the Tea Party, but I can hear the international sounds in this new release.
So the way that it was done was that I have a recording studio here on my property in the Sunshine Coast, and it has, it's got all the bells and whistles. It's like Batman's cave, you know? I've got all the tools and also, you know, all these exotic instruments that I've collected over, you know, now close to three decades, they were just hanging on the wall, you know, as art pieces. And I finally decided with the Seven Deadly Sins to bring them down, order the strings from the different countries that they came from, and brought them back to, you know, to what they needed to be for me. And as far as, like, you know, with a record like the Seven Deadly Sins, well, the anchor for me would be the drums. Mm. And so one of my best friends, Darren Evans, who lives in Noosa, you know, he's quite proficient at playing the big John Bonham drum kits. And so we went down to a studio in Maroochydore called The Vault. And, you know, I, much to the chagrin of, you know, the owner of that studio, I made him, you know, kind of like go through hula hoops, like to bring the studio like back to an analog situation.
Ah, right.
And recorded the drums at the vault, and then everything else was done up here at my studio. And you know, I took my time, like, because there wasn't really a rush to get things done, and I wanted to make sure that every single song had its moments and had my absolute, you know, undying, you know, devotion and attention.
I was reading about your recording process during COVID as well, because the Tea Party put out a couple of EPs in that time, and everyone seemed to learn during COVID to record separately and do a, you know, a track each and then merge it all, and the singer would do maybe the last bit or whatever. You must have been doing that all the time with the Tea Party, I'm guessing.
It's not my preference, that's yeah. for sure. You know, I mean, but like with the last two EPs of the Tea Party, so EP 1, Black River, and EP 2, Blood Moon Rising, we managed, whilst we were in Canada, to get down all of those, you know, all those bed tracks, you know, so Jeff and Stuart could play together, right? Because that's important for a rhythm section.
Yeah,
right?
Of course, yeah.
But I would obviously give them tracers to play to. So I would have to compose, arrange the song, and then Jeff and Stuart play to that, send it back to me, and then I do the rest of the production on top of that.
Was it the same for your last EP as well? I think it was Sunshower. Was it separately as well, or did you manage to get them all together?
Sunshower came from recording sessions that we did together whilst we were in Canada.
Right.
So the bedroom, okay. Right?
Yeah.
So they were just in the vault, and then I took them and I did what I had to do, right? But like, for instance, Becca, have you seen the video that we did during the pandemic for, we covered Joy Division's song Isolation.
Isolation, yes, yes. And I don't think I saw the video, but I heard the audio anyway. But I do remember in the middle of all that, you did Isolation.
Basically, Isolation was done in isolation. And it was like, it was the first attempt, the three of us, you know, recording remotely. And actually, you know, like, so I did the tracers at my previous property in northern New South Wales. Burroughs cut the drums in our hometown of Windsor, Ontario, Canada. And Stuart did his parts in Vancouver. And then, you know, it all gets sent back to me. And then, you know, and then the video, my friend Bill Blair had this unique opportunity in Sydney when it was absolutely shut down. There was no one on the streets, no nothing. And he's one of the premier drone videographers.
Oh, yeah.
And he was allowed to go into Sydney when there was no one on the streets and do this video. Like, imagine, like, the Harbour Bridge with nothing on it.
Yeah.
You know, like the CBD of Sydney, no one in. You know, in the videos, it's quite it's beautifully disturbing. You know?
Yeah, no, I remember back. You know, I was one of the lucky ones who could still go into work, and you know, walking down George Street in Sydney, and it was eerie. It was such a weird time. It was obviously tough on a lot of people. I know you were living up the Northern Rivers at that point, and you were sort of badly affected by those floods up in the Northern Rivers, weren't you?
Well, actually, to be quite truthful, we weren't, because the floods happened probably about 4 weeks after we decided to leave and move up here to the Sunshine Coast.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So the unfortunate people that bought our house, it ended up being so bad that the house actually slid down the mountain like about 3 meters.
Yeah, wow.
And to our knowledge, still to this day, it was unlivable.
And obviously you don't want to go back. It sounds like you had a piece of paradise, so it must be sort of hard to think about that.
It is, and I feel so, feel so bad for the people that had to endure that catastrophic, situation.
So what brought you to Australia? Because I know you traveled a lot before then, and you lived in places like Ireland, and you had a band in Ireland, and Egypt as well, and Prague, I think, from memory. So you're well traveled being a musician, but what brought you to Australia? I mean, we love you here in Australia, obviously.
Well, thank you. My eldest son was born in Perth in 2004. And I have a younger son that's, lives in Ocean Shores, Byron Bay, right? And then, of course, my beautiful wife, Melissa Barrett Martin. Well, she kind of keeps me here.
So. Where were your second biggest market in the world? I remember it was the 1998 tour, and I was living up there, Byron Bay at the time, and you were playing the Ballina RSL, and it was the biggest thing to happen all year.
Well, the thing about the Australian audience, which it doesn't change, because actually every time the Tea Party comes and tours here, I have to be perfectly honest, it probably gets bigger because our fans stay. They don't go away. But then they've got children, and they turn their children on to the Tea Party, right? So the audience is just exponentially getting bigger. And I think it's a testament, especially to the rock audience that exists here in Australia. They're willing to listen to things that aren't, so pedestrian. So the Tea Party's music, and as much as we explored, different cultures and everything within the tangent, the framework of hard rock music, Australia was always willing to follow suit and explore it with us, and it continues to this day.
Yeah, and then I remember a lot of Canadian bands would come to Australia and do sort of residencies, because I think both countries are very similar. I remember a band called The Trues. I don't know if you ever sort of crossed paths with them at some stage, but everyone described them as Canada's Powderfinger almost. They came and moved to Australia for a couple of years, and they were doing the same thing.
Yeah, well, I know the boys from The Trues very well, and they're great rock bands. It's certainly apples and oranges. Like The Trues are sort of like classic rock, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of Canadian bands, because of the monster, down south called America, the United States of America, a lot of bands in Canada are influenced by American rock. Right.
Yeah.
It's sure and certain that the Tea Party, that's not the case.
I can see why you've slotted into the Australian way of life so well. Is there any sort of Aussie things that you kind of find surprise you really enjoy? Like, do you sit down and watch the footy?
No, I watch the cricket.
Okay, you watch the cricket. Well, that's even further beyond what I expected.
I know, but it's so relaxing, especially the Test matches. Yeah.
There's something about the Test matches where, what it's like. You can just leave it on all day. You don't have to watch it all day, but you just leave and come back and, cook lunch and come back to the TV. And sure, you can have a nap in front of the cricket as well, because the ambience kind of works well for that.
See, the thing is this, Becca, Melissa kind of refuses to allow me to buy any more guitars because I have more guitars than anyone, right? and so now I've transferred my passion for buying guitars to buying things that I can put on fire, like a big Texas offset smoker, a hibachi, like a charcoal spit situation, right? So you're right, I'll put the Test match on and I'll just put the barbecue on and have a dad nap, and just see what happens. So
low and slow. I'm going to have to come up and take you up on an invite. I wanted to ask you, what is your favorite guitar? Because I knew you had a huge collection, and I was always wondering whether it was one of your early ones that you've had for so many years, or is it something you bought recently?
Well, I'm staring at it right now. So here's the story. I have a 1916 Gibson harp guitar. Have you ever seen a Gibson harp guitar?
No, I haven't. So you're going to have to describe it for me.
Well, basically, it's half a harp and half a six-string acoustic, right? And it's one of the most beautiful instruments that Gibson ever made. And the story behind this is that the one that I have is one of six in existence.
Wow.
So Orville Gibson, who was the founder of the Gibson Guitar Company, and he was a luthier by trade, up until 1916, the harp guitar was the flagship for the Gibson Guitar Company, you know, because they made these beautiful acoustics and mandolins and mandolas, all that, right?
Yeah.
But the harp guitar was the Rolls Royce, right? And he would hand make these, and 1916 was the last year that he handmade these. So I have one. Jimmy Page has one. David Gilmour from Pink Floyd has one, and the other three are in Japan.
When was the last album or EP you've used this on?
The Seven Deadly Sins.
I was hoping you'd say that. Tell us about The Seven Deadly Sins with this album. Obviously, a lot of passion and time went into it. Give me a feel for what you're listening to when you were coming up with it.
I listen to a lot of music from Turkey, from Morocco, from India, from the Middle East, Egypt, Tunisia, Syria. And I listen to a lot of classical music, like... So maybe some people would think that that I listen to, like rock music, and I don't, you know, because I do that creatively. Like, that's the music I make. But what I'm searching for are new sounds and new melodies and new instruments and whatever I can do to, you know, just push it further. You know, it's always about pushing the envelope, right? Or else, you know, you're just resting on your laurels, and then, you know, what's the point of creating? And so with the Seven Deadly Sins, the concept of it all came from my manager, Tim Pellegrino. Tim was a big fan of the Tea Party, and he was an even bigger fan of, like, the darker moments of the Tea Party, like some of the stuff from Edges of Twilight, certainly Transmission, some of the stuff from Triptych, and even some songs from the last full record that the Tea Party did, which was The Ocean at the End. And so when Tim came on board, and this would have been probably about 4 or 5 years ago, the first record that we did together, him managing me, was Cinnamon Rose. Now, Cinnamon Rose, I'm very proud of, but to say it was dark would be, well, that's a lie. It was, like, filled with love and, a lot of songs, definitely two or three songs written, towards my wife. And, it's a very joyous record, right? But then Tim, during the pandemic, because money was scarce and touring was... hit and miss. So Tim decided to do a something called a Pausable campaign, where, reaching out to the fans and, you know, what kind of record do you want Jeff Martin to do, right? And it was a resounding situation where they wanted me to explore, especially like the exotic instruments that the Tea Party was known for, but also explore the darkness, and you know, which I've been known for as well. And so Tim was the one that came up with the concept of the seven deadly sins. Now, for me, as a composer, I had never written towards a concept.
Yeah.
I've always written, you know, basically coming from, you know, true life, you know, my life, you know, and then kind of blurring the lines here and there, right? But an absolute concept was very foreign to me. When Tim brought this concept to my attention, initially, I was like, you know what? This is cool. I'm going to give this a red hot go. But I must admit that at the beginning stages of it all, I found it arduous, found it a little bit difficult, right? Because I'm not writing from a personal point of view, but I'm writing, you know, like Dante's Inferno, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and it gives you almost structure you don't want if you're a songwriter, because I can imagine, you know, a lot of the times you just want to just come up with songs about how you're feeling right now, and you might come up with a riff or whatever, but if you're writing about the seven deadly sins, it does mean you can't stray away too far.
No, you can't. And but I found, once I got my groove, right, because I basically, for the seven songs, well, actually for six of them, I wrote the music first, and I let the music settle in with me. And I hadn't even like picked a sin for those six, right? I just let it settle in, and I waited. You know, it's kind of like waiting for the ether, right? You know, to like, you know, kind of sprinkle it down and tell you what it's going to be. And I trusted in that situation, and it worked.
And the great thing about, you know, involving your fans, you've got different levels of support as well, I noticed as well, which is great, but you're including them on the journey, and also you're giving them an early release as well. So, you know, they've obviously all got a copy of it before it goes out to everyone else. And I think it's just such a smart idea because everyone's invested in it. They all feel a bit of pride knowing they're involved.
Yeah, well, it certainly worked out for the best. I believe as long as I put out music that's laced with integrity, they're going to continue to follow me. And that's my mission. Keep the integrity and, you know, do what thou wilt.
So from Seven Deadly Sins, I wanted to go right back to the beginning because you guys met all in your own hometown and it took you a little while to get the band going, but there's something about some of those bands back then, especially where you all grew up together. So I think it's incredible you guys are still playing together.
Yeah, you know, what's actually kind of pleasantly disturbing is that we might have been together almost as long as the Rolling Stones.
Bloody hell.
Because,
okay,
because this is what you have to understand. When I was nine and Jeff Burrows, the drummer of the Tea Party, was 10, we formed our first band and we played at our primary school, like the gymnasium, in front of like 800 screaming kids. The only reason they were screaming was because they got to get out of class to watch this, right?
That's good. They're fair.
I'm singing, playing guitar, Jeff's on drums, and you know, there's a few other grade school friends. And we're doing the Beatles. Like we did Revolution, Help, and I saw her standing there. And for anyone that understands, you know, listening to this podcast, understands the deepness of my voice. There's actual recordings that Jeff Burroughs' father did on an old 8-track that I sound like Michael Jackson on helium.
Wow. Bands that have managed to get through all those years, and look, you had a hiatus, but the fact that you can call each other up and go, hey, let's give it a try. What led to the break in 2005, by the way? Was it just you just needed the break?
No, it's complicated.
Yeah, it always is.
I'll try to make it as least complicated as possible. But our manager of the Tea Party, his name was Steve Hoffman, and his management company, SRO, who also managed Rush, he kind of headhunted us after the success of The Edges of Twilight back in 95, 96, right?
Yeah.
So we signed to SRO with Steve Hoffman as our main guy. And Steve was very much the instigator of the success, the succession of successes that the band had after The Edges of Twilight. So Transmission, Triptych, Tangents, right? But after Tangents, which came out, I believe, in 2000 or something like that, 2001, Steve was diagnosed with a form of cancer, lung cancer, that just decimates you. Like, there's no coming back from it. And he was only 38 years old. But for me, Steve was my big brother. And he was also, for any Led Zeppelin fans out there, like, you know, who knows the story about Led Zeppelin, like how Peter Grant, the manager of Led Zeppelin, just wouldn't let anyone come near the band, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what Steve Hoffman was for the Tea Party. Like, he told EMI what they were going to do. He made sure that EMI stayed away from the artistic process, right? So I was allowed to produce, and we just did our thing.
Mm.
And we made EMI a lot of money, and they made us some. And but when Steve passed away, there was no one captain the ship, And then, unfortunately, there was too many cooks in the kitchen. Without Steve, EMI was allowed to come in and pressure the band to become more commercially viable as far as, like, the sound.
Yeah.
Is concerning.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't have a problem with the sales, but they just thought that, oh, well, if the Tea Party became more accessible, almost like on a rock pop sort of thing, well, then maybe they could, like, even grab more money from us, right? And it was something that after Steve left this world, I didn't have my defender, and I just got so despondent with the situation, because, I mean, I have to be perfectly honest, like, with that last records before we parted ways, Seven Circles, there's pockets of provision on that record that I'm proud of, but I'm not proud of most of it. And it's just because there was too many compromises being made. And then that left a really bad taste in my mouth, and I had to leave. I had to figure out how to find passion in making music again, and that's what led me to Ireland, of all places.
Yeah, how long were you there? Was it just a couple of years?
It's about 3 in total.
Yeah. And you had a new band there, and you obviously, I hope you enjoyed beer, because I couldn't imagine anyone moving to Ireland. Oh, beer and whiskey, actually, to be fair.
Yeah, it's funny you mention that. there was this, where I lived, where I had this house in Ireland, the house was a 350-year-old stone farmhouse. and it overlooked a bay called Dunmanis Bay, which is right down southwest in Ireland, right outside the Atlantic Ocean, and about 10 minutes up the road from my stone farmhouse that I had was one of the oldest pubs in Ireland. It was built in 1670.
Amazing.
And it boasts, still to this day, like the best Guinness, poured Guinness, because it has the shortest lines, you know, to the actual kegs, right? And the Guinness comes directly from Dublin. And yeah, that was my my drink of choice. I would have a small Guinness and then a shot of Jameson's whiskey. And then I'd have another, and then I'd have another, and then I'd have another.
That's what you need when you're on a break. So you did Ireland, and then a few years after that, you managed to get the Tea Party back on the road. I remember it was just a summer rumor at that point, because I think you were on the bill for a couple of festivals, and I think it might have been Jeff was had a radio show. Is that right? And he might have let it slip.
Yeah, he did at that time. Yeah.
There was something going on, and then I guess it was like a test case. And if you got back on stage and you enjoyed it again, well, let's keep it going.
Tell you what, after 7 years of being apart, right? I mean, I played with some incredible musicians like Wayne Shee from Ireland, Malcolm Clark and Jay Cortez in Perth. I played with Terrapi Richmond, Mick Skelton, you know, from the Baby Animals, like oh, yeah. All these incredible musicians, right? But coming back to the Tea Party after 7 years, and, you know, I have to be honest, like, it wasn't, you know, I mean, it was pretty icy at first, you know, because there was a lot of hard feelings. But the one thing that set that all straight was when we got into that rehearsal space again after 7 years, and I think the first song we played was The River, and it was like, okay, I remember why I love this band so much, you know, because there's something about the three of us where we don't have to think. We just know
it's muscle, what's going muscle to happen. Memory. Yeah, that's right.
But also, like, even if we go into improvisation, we don't have to think. They know where I'm going, and I know where they're going, you know, and it's a beautiful, beautiful chemistry.
And I'm so glad you did it, because that was a tragedy. But I think some bands do need a break. I mean, it may not be 7 years. It could just be 12 months. But, you know, you're more than family when you're on the road a lot and when you're recording. And I think it's just good for the health to have a break from someone and reignite the passion. And by the way, before we go, you almost had a chance to sell teaparty.com for a lot of money. And I think this was over sort of maybe 10 or 15 years ago now.
Yeah,
you almost did, and it didn't end up happening, but you could have really cashed in.
We could have, but the fact of the matter was, is that who we would have to sell it to, like, back at that time, it was the Tea Party movement in America.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
so kind of like what MAGA has become now.
Yep.
In America.
Yeah,
right. And just in good conscience, like, even though it could have been, you know, we could have retired, right? In good conscience, we just could not give them another platform to spread, you know, which basically is hate, you know, white supremacy, you know, all that stuff, you know, that, well, America is still facing, you know, because let's face it, even though, you know, the guy's up on criminal charges, people are still going to vote for him.
Yeah, I know. Must have been a hell of a dilemma, though. A lot of money.
Well, yeah, I can sleep soundly at night. Yeah,
so. Exactly. Yeah, and that is the main thing. You got to live with yourself. I never got around to asking about your producing, and I want to talk about that night I crashed your studio. So I turned up with your mate Sarah McLeod. She was well on her way, and I think I was too, but she was definitely well on her way, and you were recording a band called Lepers and Crooks.
Yeah, but do you remember that I had to kick you and Sarah out?
You did. I felt so responsible because I was meant to be the responsible adult, and Sarah was just... Oh, she had so many whiskeys and beers, I think, before then. And I think we came from a Gibson function, so obviously it was free beer the whole night. And you just had to politely kick her out. And I was standing there just thinking, oh, my God, I brought her down and I ruined this whole moment.
No, but she didn't. It was it was Lepers and Crooks, right, yes, the band.
That's right, yeah.
And, it's funny enough – I spoke to Pat a few days ago. Pat is he was the second guitarist in Lepers and Crooks.
Yeah. Right?
I ended up producing the rest of the records at River House, the first property that Melissa and I had. And Chris Murphy from INXS, right? God bless his soul. He was managing them at the time. Unfortunately, because of Chris's illness, right, and subsequently passing away, the Lepers and Crooks record really didn't see the light of day. But we had a conversation, Pat and I, about it, and they really want to get it out there, and so do I, because I'm very proud of the work that I did with those boys. They're a great rock band.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I was devastated that they were on the cusp of something really big, and the whole band were tight, and then they were also hard workers. I think that's the most important thing. They were okay with jumping in the van and playing, you know, hundreds of gigs.
It's a testament to the band because they were ready, willing, and able. Do you remember the SNL skits with Will Ferrell and he's in Blue Oyster Cult and it's too much cowbell?
The cowbell, yeah.
So essentially, you know, like to cut the ice with the band, right? Because, you know, they're all like at that point, you know, we hadn't really become friends yet. So they're at a point where they're just starstruck, right? Jeff Martin, you know, blah, blah, blah. Right?
A bunch of kids, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So I did the whole thing. I went in with a cowbell in like my back pocket and I went into the recording, the live room, right? And all the five boys were in there. Right? And I was like, guys, listen, I just want you to know, right, that I love what you're putting down. I love what you're putting down, right? But where's the drummer? Oh, is it you? Yes, it's you, right? Listen, right? I've made those Tea Party records, right? I produced those Tea Party records. I've made hits, you know? I've done this, I've done that. But all I want to say to you all right now, and I'm talking to you drummer, right? And I pull it out from my back pocket, right, with a drumstick, right? It's like, duke, duke, duke. I need more cowbell, right? And they all hit the ground laughing, and that was the way to break the ice.
Oh, God, I love it. Well, Jeff, it is so great to catch up, and Seven Deadly Sins is out. On the 7th of the 7th, and I know it's a big passion of yours, and I wish it all the success. And
now I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So you've listened to the record.
Yeah.
What's your favorite song?
When I was driving, and I put in Pride. Well, I love the opening track as well, which...
Lust.
So it's either Lust or Pride. I think Pride was the one.
Okay. Well, I have to... I have one more story to tell you before we part ways.
Yeah.
The seventh song on the record, it's called Sloth. Right? And so here's the thing. As I said earlier in our talk, you know, this record took me some time, you know, to do, right? Because of, you know, the whole thing about like writing to a concept, right?
Yeah.
So with the seventh song, Sloth. Now, it was my intention that it was going to be an instrumental, you know, because usually on my records, like, I have an instrumental. And I was thinking that, you know, well, you know, the seventh song, you know, just to end the record, well, that would be a beautiful thing, right?
Yeah.
I'm in my studio because I was kind of going for like a Daniel Lanois, Brian Eno production for that song, right? And I'm creating all these layers. And I'm left, you know, alone in the studio. It's my own devices. And then all of a sudden, a melody starts coming through to me. And I'm like, oh, fuck. And it's coming in strong, right? Because remember I said to you, like, the ether, you know, will sprinkle down things. Mm. And you got to pay attention, right? Okay, so the melody's coming through. And now I'm starting to hum it. And I'm realizing that, okay, well, this is not going to be an instrumental. And then I realize, I think about when I have to go away and tour and I have to leave Melissa and I have to leave this beautiful home and our little dog. And Melissa would always say to me, you know, honey, you're safe amongst the stars. So now I've got a lyric, right? That's going with that melody. And I'm like, oh, shit. Right. So it took me honestly like one evening, and I came back into the house and I said to Melissa, because I put a mix down, right? I said, like, honey, I don't know how to explain this to you. And I know that this was supposed to be an instrumental, but I've got to play you something. And I played it for her, and we were both in tears. And honestly, for me, that song, Sloth, You're Safe Amongst the Stars, is probably my favorite off of The Seven Deadly Sins.
And I hope the fans treasure this album. And I know that the fans who were involved with the campaign as well most definitely will. But look, Jeff, I know it's a really important one for you, and you and Melissa as well. And it's a pleasure to catch up with you. And Seven Deadly Sins is out on the 7th. And Jeff Martin, once again, thank you for being on the podcast, The Writer.
My pleasure, buddy.
What a legendary bloke there he is. Jeff Martin, check out the new album, Seven Deadly Sins, coming out July 7th, or the 7th of the 7th. This is The Writer with Becco. Thank you for subscribing on all platforms, including Apple and Spotify, and even Pandora. In the next episode, we catch up with Nathan Cavalieri. You'd know him as the child star who you would have seen on Hey Hey It's Saturday and Macca's ads, but we're going to talk to Nathan Cavalieri about everything that happened since then. The transition from being child star to awkward teenager to a guy trying to make it in the music industry. He's got a brand new album out. We'll catch up with Nathan Cavalieri in the next episode of The Writer with Becco. Catch you then.